So thank you for your introduction, and I'm very grateful to be invited to participate in this meeting. Of course, I remember the pleasure of meeting François Jacob quite some years ago, and I think the only justification for my being here is that during the last, I think, 10 years of his life, he turned over to the problem of development and used teratocarcinoma cells as a way into that problem. Of course, they turned out to be immensely successful in the course of time, since embryonic stem cells really derived from those. Nevertheless, my other connection with François is rather limited, but I'm indeed grateful here to celebrate his amazing career. So I'd like to talk about this whole subject of nuclear reprogramming, and I'll say a bit at the beginning about the background to the subject, why it might be of interest, a little bit about nuclear transfer to eggs, and then mainly about mechanisms of reprogramming, mainly as revealed by the use of things called oocytes. So it's important to remember that when this work started in the 1950s, we did not know whether all cells of the body have the same genes. That was why the work was done, first successful experiments by Briggs and King. Subsequently, that approach has proved useful for understanding some problems in development, notably cell fate, and more recently, of course, it's attracted enormous interest because of the possibility of cell replacement. It's interesting to reflect that when the early work was done, there was no suggestion by anybody that this could actually lead to any kind of cell replacement. That was not even considered at that time, and it's only relatively recently that the reprogramming that does happen when you do nuclear transfer or use other methods has been shown to be potentially of enormous value for cell replacement. I need to tell you the bottom line of this talk. That is that when you transplant a nucleus to an egg, it undergoes reprogramming, but it doesn't do it perfectly. The egg, if one thinks about it, is designed to transform sperm into an embryo-active nucleus. The egg is designed that way, and it does that almost perfectly. When you transplant a somatic nucleus into the egg, it tries to do the same. On the other hand, the nucleus of a somatic cell is designed for just the opposite. It's designed to maintain the same pattern of gene expression for very long periods of time, and indeed, the nucleus, as it were, tries to resist the efforts of the egg to reactivate genes. So we see a kind of conflict of interest between the egg and the incoming nucleus, and that tells us to some extent why it is that the procedure works at all, and indeed why it does not work perfectly. So that's the conclusion I will want to arrive at. By way of introduction, the procedure which is used, or was used for this, is to start with something like skin, separate the cells, and transfer the nucleus in pink from one of those cells into the egg. The egg's own chromosomes are killed by radiation. And in some cases, this combination of the skin cell nucleus and the cytoplasm of the egg can form an entirely normal, sexually mature frog initially, and more recently it's now been done, same principle, to a wide range of mammalian species. the early stages, I like to remind myself at the early stages, when I was given the project by my supervisor to try and do nuclear transfer, the first major problem was that when you tried to inject a needle into the egg, it wouldn't go in at all. The egg is covered with a very elastic, viscous jelly, and the needle simply pushes the jelly right through the egg out the other end. So it was actually impossible to do this experiment, but by more by luck than anything else, we came across a source of ultraviolet light which happens to kill the egg chromosomes. That's very convenient, but amazingly it also denatured the jelly. That's not normal for ultraviolet lights, and it turned out in retrospect that the kind of UV source used at that time had a very unusual emission at about 2,200 angstrom, and that was what was doing this. And it was an amazing piece of good fortune to find that way of making eggs actually penetrable. Otherwise, the experiments must have failed. And the other problem at an early stage, this was all in my early graduate work, was to make a needle rather like a wasp sting. When you break off a needle with only a few microns diameter, it breaks off like that. But this is quite damaging to an egg, so one has to make a machine which, under the microscope, will forge the end into this kind of spine while still leaving a space for the broken cell to enter. And that those two problems, fortunately, were solved fairly early on, so that it was possible to transplant the nucleus of a somatic cell into the egg. The other absolutely crucial discovery at that time, made by my supervisor, Michael Fishberg, was the discovery of a mutation. This mutation causes the nuclei of cells to have one nucleolus. In the wild type, called two nucleolus, there are usually two. And this turned out to be a genetic mutation. And you can see here that in most cells, the two nucleoli are very prominent. Occasionally they fuse, but most of the time you can see two nucleoli very clearly, whereas in the mutant, which is a heterozygous mutant, there is only one nucleolus. This is explained because the nucleolus forms at the site of ribosomal gene activity, forms the ribosomes, and of course there are two sets of these genes in a normal animal. Each nucleolus has the site of about 450 copies of the 28 and 18S ribosomal genes, and if they're near each other, they fuse into one. But it turns out that the animals don't need so many ribosomal genes. Half the number is entirely satisfactory. So the heterozygous one-nucleolated animal is entirely usable and was a wonderful genetic marker for these experiments. So that made it possible to go to the main point, which is to ask whether a specialized tissue like the intestine cells can be used to provide a normal individual after nuclear transfer. The intestine that's the food in the intestine, but if one transplants the nucleus of an intestinal epithelium cell, you usually get early embryos of this kind, where about half the embryo is undivided, dead, and the other half makes normal cells. These embryos will always die. However, if you take these cells and retransplant a nucleus as a serial nuclear transfer, you often get fairly normal development. So that's an important part of the technique. Having done that, one can obtain tadpoles. This is all in the frog, Xenopus tadpoles, looking about the same, whether they're from a fertilized egg or from intestine. And if you look at the eye of such a tadpole derived by cloning from an intestine cell, it is a normal eye with lens and various layers of retinal epithelium and so on. Of course, all these several thousand cells come from a cell whose nucleus was once part of an intestine epithelium. So it illustrates the extent to which there is a reprogramming of that intestine cell nucleus. When you summarize these figures, these results, the first thing that's very clear is that if you start with a nucleus of an embryo, blastula or blastocyst, some 30% or so will develop essentially normally. It'll reach birth in mammals or feeding tadpoles in frogs. But as you take nuclei from later stages, even adult, the success rate goes right down. That illustrates the kind of resistance that the somatic nuclei have for being reprogrammed. It's about the same in mammals or in Xenopus, this substantial decline, which we'll come to later. So this is a summary of that part of the early work. Here's the transplanted nucleus. And the point of this diagram is that the probability of getting a sexually normal, sexually mature adult frog is only about 2% of all of the nuclei transplanted. So it works, but not efficiently. I'd like to quote this experiment of Wakayama. We did one like this in frogs, and he did a better one in mice. So it shows that when you do serial nuclear transfers by using a cumulus cell nucleus transplanted to an egg, grow a, in this case a mouse, and do the same thing again and again, he could get 25 serial nuclear transfer generations. It's about 500 cell divisions per generation. And what he found was you still get normal mice at the end, and it implies that there's a kind of indefinite rejuvenation by the cytoplasm of this transplanted nucleus. Interesting to me is that there was no incidence of cancer even after these divisions. So there is a clearly major reprogramming effect of excitoplasm on transplanted nuclei. Now I'll just say a quick word about epigenetic memory. This was really first established in frog work, but it's now become clear that this happens in all kinds of reprogramming experiments. The experiment went like this. Start with a tadpole, take a muscle cell, transplant its nucleus, grow an embryo, and then remove the part of the embryo which is going to form muscle and preserve the future neuroectoderm and endoderm. And what it turns out is that the expression of muscle genes is very high in the nerve cells and the endoderm, remembering that the nucleus came initially from muscle. This is largely attributable to a particular component, histone 8.3, of which the egg has a large supply. And this, when you use a mutant and inactivate it, there is no memory. The point is that this particular component seems to preserve an active transcriptional state of an incoming nucleus, and so create a memory of the donor cell state. So to summarize this part, these are the conclusions so far. Of course, the most important thing is that all cells in the body, so nearly all, have a complete genome. Egg cytoplasm has a remarkable ability to reprogram gene expression back to an embryonic state. As cells differentiate, their nuclei become increasingly resistant to reprogramming. And this resistance is often seen as a kind of epigenetic memory. So that's the background. And I now want to move to how we might explore the mechanism of this reprogramming. We need to know that in normal animals, invertebrates in particular, the germ cell gradually enlarges and becomes the mature oocyte or progenitor egg. That takes a long time in frogs. the oocyte in just a few hours is switched into an egg, which is fertilizable, and in a few more hours already cells of the embryo start undergoing lineage selection. Now, the experiments I've mentioned involve nuclear transfer to an egg, which is followed by a massive phase of very rapid DNA replication for several hours, after which transcription starts. So the incoming nucleus is quiescent to start with, and then it starts being transcribed. But during this enforced replication phase, there is enormous chromosome damage. The incoming nucleus is not prepared to replicate that fast, and the chromosomes get badly damaged. Here are fragments of chromosomes different from a normal chromosome set. So what one can do now is to transplant nuclei to the oocyte, in particular to the nucleus of the oocyte, usually a few hundred nuclei, when you get intense transcription with no DNA replication. And these very same transplanted somatic nuclei undergo changes in gene expression over a matter of some days. This is the amphibian oocyte, a large cell, and in it is this enormous structure called the germinal vesicle. That's of special interest to us, and you don't see this unless you take it out, but it is there. And if you look at these oocytes, they're rather like an organ. Each oocyte is covered with thousands of follicle cells. You have to remove those to inject it. And indeed, there's a blood supply. So each oocyte is like a miniature organ, but it nevertheless is one single cell. And in that germinal vesicle, the oocyte's own chromosomes have these amazing structures of lamp brush chromosomes, they're called, enormously extended loops of DNA, intensely active in transcription. So the oocyte is one of the most actively transcribed cells known, estimated perhaps at being about 1,000 times more active in transcription than a somatic cell nucleus. I show it here. This is the germinal vesicle. These spots are actually nucleoli. They're amplified sets of ribosomal genes. In fact, there are about 1,000 nucleoli per germinal vesicle and 1,000 ribosomal genes in each nucleolus. The important point is that the germinal vesicle is packed full of these isolated little gene sets, which it transcribes with immense efficiency. So it's an intensely actively transcribing cell. The germinal vesicle is marked in red, and its contents, which are a reserve of materials for development, normally are distributed to the egg when the oocyte becomes an egg, and then to the embryo. And these substances are required for normal development. When you look at the efficiency of reprogramming after this nuclear transfer, you can see that within a few days it reaches something like 95%. So almost all the nuclei undergo this transformation, turning on these pluripotency markers, and it's an efficient process, makes it suitable for analysis. Just a small point that the gene activity in these transplanted nuclei is selective. It's not as if the oocyte turns everything back into a universally transcribed state. It's quite selective. Turns on some genes, turns others off, like, of course, all cells do. And this is probably a general principle of all kinds of cells, that they are continually reinforcing their own pattern of gene expression, imposing that where they can on incoming nuclei. Same for cell fusion experiments. I make this point quickly, which is that when you transplant these nuclei, there is an enormously efficient not only reprogramming, but transcriptional activation. So if you measure the number of new transcriptions per gene per day, some genes like SOX2 are transcribed enormously fast and recurrently. And that is another special advantage of using these cells. The mechanism involved is primarily that of causing the entry of a very special histone called B4. It's a very abundant histone in the oocyte. And this time-lapse picture shows that almost all of the incoming nuclei have taken up the red-marked linker histone from the oocyte, except for two, and those are ones where a whole cell was injected as a kind of negative control. This is probably the single most important event of reprogramming. It happens within a couple of hours, and I needn't dwell on these points, but just summarize what we know of the reprogramming by saying within a few hours, you get this special histone called B4, another one, histone 83, you get histone changes, actually nuclear actin polymerization, and within about a day, you get transcription with polymerase II. So the whole process is a very rapidly occurring enforced transcription on available genes in the transplanted nucleus. So conclusion from this part is that nuclear transfer to these meiotic oocytes gives something like a 95% reprogramming in 24 hours. The reprogramming is gene selective, and the reprogramming by oocytes requires a hierarchical sequence of events, at least some of which we now know. So I now want to switch to the question of resistance. I've mentioned that most of the nuclear transfer experiments show incomplete reprogramming, reflecting the resistance of the incoming nuclei. And this seems to us to reflect the stability of cell differentiation. So as I mentioned, somatic cells have nuclei which are not supposed to change dramatically from one lineage to another. And so the pattern of gene expression of cells, somatic cells, is actually very stable once it's been established. So we'd like to know very much what is the basis of this resistance, what causes the stability, normal stability, of cell differentiation, and could we use this to improve the efficiency of reprogramming, particularly for cell replacement work? There are a number of things known, and most of these I'm not going to dwell on. These are mechanisms that contribute to resistance. DNA methylation is one, which keeps genes switched off. That accounts for a few cases of resistance. We particularly know about the macro H2A, which is responsible for the inactive X chromosome. Histone modifications, some of these occur. Again, they contribute a bit, but not everything, to the stability of cell differentiation. I will say a little bit about cell cycle phase, and lastly, I'll talk a bit about transcription factors. So I'm skipping some of these things because we don't need to dwell on those, but I'm going to make the point that mitosis, the normal mitosis, can destabilize chromatin, rather surprisingly. The evidence is this. It amounts to saying that there's a special window of opportunity as cells progress, so that at each mitosis, a cell has a short chance to change its pattern of gene expression, change in gene transcription. And this is determined by transplanting nuclei in mitosis. It's actually very difficult to synchronize embryonic cells in mitosis, so you can't do that, but you can use cultured cells, in this case C2C12, and if you synchronize them in mitosis, you get an enormous abundance of nuclei actually in mitosis. So it's possible to transplant nuclei in mitosis rather than in all different parts of the cell cycle. Computer likes to interrupt my talks at some point with useless information. Right, so we go back to that one. It keeps telling me something that I don't really want to know much about, so I'll have to try and see if I can... Oh no, it's gone right back to the beginning. I have this permanent trouble of these computers. See if I can get it back more or less to where we want to be. Where were we? We were about there, so I think that's more or less where we think we are. Try that one. Yes, that's I think where we are. This says you can obtain a suspension of nuclei in mitosis. Now, when you transplant those into this oocyte system, there is this enormous increase in transcription of genes, and most clearly exemplified by SOX2, something like 100-fold more active transcription of that gene as long as you transplant the chromatin in mitosis, not at other stages of the cell cycle. And we know, to cut out a lot of other information, we now know that this has a lot to do with the ubiquitinated state of histone H2A. Range of experiments show that, one of which is perhaps most striking, and that is that if you can remove nearly all the chromosomal proteins from a somatic nucleus, and it does not eliminate or affect this mitotic advantage. However, if you remove all proteins, you find that there is no, this is the mitotic advantage, there is none. So DNA itself has no such advantage, actually that's shown in this one, there is no mitotic advantage there. And the main conclusion from these experiments is that the mitotic advantage is best explained, at least in part, by the deubiquitination of histone H2A, probably lysine 119 and 120. This probably has a loosening effect on chromosome composition or the binding to DNA, and so it decreases resistance to reprogramming and decreases the stability of cell differentiation. Now, we think that this principle might be of quite general interest. So if you think of new lineages or cell types being formed in normal development, they're always preceded by a mitosis, particularly in early development. And it's known from other work that transcription factors accumulated during interphase are given access to genes at mitosis. In fact, at mitosis, transcription factors are generally removed and replaced again. So if the cell has been accumulating new transcription factors, this is the time it takes them on and resets its pattern of gene expression. So this is the concept, that there's a preferential exchange of transcription factors at mitosis, and new cell lineages are established after mitosis, and the transcription factors for new lineages generally gain access to genes at that point. So the conclusion from this bit is that mitosis causes a chromosomal protein exchange. As far as I know, mitosis is required for major changes in cell differentiation and in normal development. So it's an interesting principle that this is when new gene patterns of expression are established, and with the limited mitosis in cell-differentiated cells, the chance of cells taking on new cell fates is substantially reduced. So, and I'll summarize what I've said so far, and then the last bit I'll talk about some another kind of work. So we're saying that resistance to reprogramming reflects the stability of soul differentiation. An interesting point is that this resistance operates at levels that are different for each gene and different for one cell type to another. So I'm reminded of Edith Hurd's work on the inactive X, where again there seem to be a number of mechanisms which are used to achieve the same result. There's no single overriding way of, in this case, stabilizing cell differentiation, but rather each gene has its own type of mechanism which needs to be ultimately discovered. And the resistance to reprogramming is relieved at mitosis when the changes in cell lineage take place. So I'll now finish this talk with talking about some current work, which I'm doing with Laura Hardwick and Anna Philpott in Cambridge. And we want to know how transcription factors really work. One idea is that the stability of cell differentiation is brought about because new transcription factors don't get access to genes, and so there is no simple cell type change. And there are several things that we don't understand about how transcription factors work. Of course, there's the problem of how do they find the right sequence in a huge genome. Another important question is, what is the stability of a transcription factor on its designated site? It is thought by many people that the transcription factors are coming on and off at an amazingly fast rate, even with seconds or at most a few seconds, hardly ever a minute, as if there's a continuous exchange of transcription factors. I'm not sure that that's ever been completely established, and so one idea is to try and analyze in detail how a transcription factor works with respect to the gene that it controls. And our concept is that fundamental to this is the concentration of that factor and the time for which it is present at that concentration. So we want to, this says, how are these factors bound, and those are the questions. So the design of these experiments is the following. We take this oocyte, which I've talked about quite extensively, and you inject purified messenger RNA into the cytoplasm of this oocyte. We know that when you do that, the oocyte translates the message extremely efficiently. About 200 proteins per messenger RNA per day, and we often inject hundreds of thousands of copies of the message, and hence you build up huge numbers of copies of the transcription factor protein in this cell. So after a day, this cell is now overloaded with the relevant transcription factor which you're working with. And we have chosen to work with a neural transcription factor called ASCL, which is well studied and very important in determining cell lineage, particularly of the nervous system. So having got a cell full of transcription factor, and we mark it in pink because the factor goes into the germinal vesicle, you then inject plasmid DNA containing the ASCL binding site, and we couple that with a firefly fluorescence reporter. So you have to inject the DNA into the germinal vesicle, which you can't see, but you get used to doing this with reasonably high efficiency. As you will see, that then causes the transcription factor to create massive transcription of the injected DNA because it binds to the promoter site, and this is reported by the luciferase reporter. Now, to determine something like residence time of a transcription factor on DNA, you would ideally do a competition experiment where you let it get underway, and then after the desired amount of time, you add a plasmid DNA as a competitor, the same binding site but with a different reporter. And that means a second injection into the germinal vesicle of the oocyte. And the oocyte seems to be, this thing has somehow stopped. And, the timing has on my watch has stopped, so I have to be lost time. You inject this. Now, that means you can do a competition experiment. The plasmid DNA we use is standard sort with the E-box, pyrimidine E-box and reporter. And the main point is that when you do this, you get a massive effect. So with no mRNA or no DNA, the background is 50. With the, under the conditions where we use it, something like 100 million. So there's an enormously strong effect, very easy to work with, and you can remove parts of the plasmid and show it makes a difference. Now, the key thing now is that we can couple all this with a marker for expression of genes in the oocyte. We have another plasmid encoding GFP, and when you inject that into the oocyte, if the injection is successful into the germinal vesicle, the oocyte becomes bright green. If it's unsuccessful, it doesn't show at all. So there's a marker for how successfully you can micro-inject the DNA into the oocyte. I now come back to this picture that I showed before, and these are the thousands of nucleoli, each with 1,000 ribosomal genes. The point of this is that to inject plasmid DNA into an oocyte is in fact copying what the oocyte is designed to do. The normal oocyte is used to transcribing these thousands of nucleoli with thousands of genes very effectively, and all we're doing is putting in a plasmid, which is much like the DNA in a nucleolus, and asking it to do the same thing. So we're copying what the oocyte is really designed to do by giving it a huge number of copies of a certain gene. So here are the conclusions from this kind of work. I'm not giving you the details, but the main point is this, that under conditions of equal concentration, competitor DNA will not displace transcription factor DNA that is already bound to chromatin. So it seems that the transcription factor is bound very stably to its designated site, and it won't be competed off at all easily. However, if you reduce transcription factor concentration by fivefold and increase competitor DNA by tenfold, this 50-fold advantage will then give some visible competition. And it again means that under normal circumstances, everything is very stable, but to get a change of cell fate by transcription factors, you have to have a massive amount of overdose. So under normal conditions, transcription factor residence is stable, we would say over several hours, and this stable transcription probably has a lot to do with promoting stability of cell lineage. So, summary, my watch has stopped its timing, so I'm having to guess that we're about the right time. And the summary of the work is that somatic cell nuclear transfer to eggs shows conservation of the genome during cell differentiation. That's why the work was started. Nuclear transfer to oocytes shows mechanisms of gene activation and of resistance. And lastly, but not least, as we gradually understand more about the possibilities of nuclear reprogramming, and particularly through the transcription factor work of Yamanaka and Takahashi, we can see the real possibilities of producing cell replacement cells, and that is proving particularly useful in the case of the retinal pigmented epithelium of the eye. And a point I usually make is that the ability to get this work to patients is substantially restricted by the regulatory bodies and lawyers. I have a strong personal view that these regulatory bodies always finding reasons for not allowing some very good procedure to be used. And the reason the regulatory bodies are so hesitant, in my view, is because lawyers like to make a meal out of this, make a huge amount of money, and obstruct access of these great techniques to the public. So that's the bottom line. And just to acknowledge my colleagues who have been involved in the work, particularly mention Jérôme Julien, who is a native of France and who's been involved for so many years in this work. Thank you.